Tuesday at 7 p.m. Join host Teokas and Ghost Horse on an all-native-hosted, all-native-produced Burst of Voices Radio. Tune in for global topics and issues of critical importance to the preservation and protection of Mother Earth, presented in the voices and from the perspective of the original peoples of the world. On this week's show, Teokasen's guests are investigative journalist, philosopher, novelist, and filmmaker Andrei Volchek and Shelley Buck, president of the Prairie Island Indian Community in Minnesota. That's Tuesday at 7 p.m. here on WBAI New York.
This is Cat Radio Cafe, a salon of the arts exploring the creative bounty of New York from WBAI-FM, the Pacifica station not quite as far as it can get from Berkeley, that college town in California. I'm Janet Coleman. You are?
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. On this show, novelist-poet Jaime Manriquez, now appearing in the documentary What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael. Also, playwright Shawnee Sucre, whose play The Eighth refers to the repeal of Ireland's anti-abortion Eighth Amendment, and composer Craig Shepherd on Broken Silence, Music for Contemplation, addressing the sex scandal on the Catholic Church. Jolly listening.
And in the next hour of Cat Radio Cafe, a panel discussion on
gigs. And now, welcome, poet, novelist Jaime Manrique, who is the author of Latin Moon Over Manhattan, Cervantes Street, about four or five other novels, and about five volumes of poetry, including the collection that includes the poem on Christopher Columbus on his deathbed. Well-deserved deathbed in that poem, as I recall. Welcome to Cat Radio Cafe again. I haven't been here in a long time. But, you know,
Thank you, Janet.
We were together at a birthday party in which you mentioned that you were going to be in the documentary on Pauline Kael, and I rushed out to see it, and I thought, well, you are pretty much in it. And the movie itself it's a film form, quite arresting, partly due to the controversial nature of Pauline Kael and her character and her entire career, really, in both adoring and assaulting the movies in a way that had never been done by a critic. But you were in the film, you were practically, I think, the only one, a writer, who was not a film critic or attached really to the film world in any way, but on your own, a literary figure. How did you happen to meet Pauline Kael? Not explained in the film.
It's a long story. I met Pauline Kael, I think it was in 1973. She was actually the first person I met in New York. I came here because a professor of mine at the college where I went to school in Florida had given me a book of Pauline Kael's Deeper Into Movie, which won the National Book Award. I was in Colombia at that time in my country, and she sent me the book there, and I read it, and I loved it, and I wrote a long letter to her telling her why I liked it so much, and that was it. And then my professor liked my letter so much, she sent a copy to Pauline Kael at The New Yorker. And then Pauline wrote back to my teacher and said, oh, what a wonderful relationship you have with Jaime. I'm very moved and whatever, whatever. And if you ever come to New York, please call me and we can have a meal. So I understood that to mean that if I came to New York, she would take me to a meal. And I decided to come to New York to meet Pauline Kael.
Where did you have the meal?
Where did I?
Do you remember?
The meal, where did we have it?
Yeah.
No, first we met at the Algonquin. It was my first day in New York. The second day, and I was in Queens. I had never really been to New York except one day briefly. And then she said, oh, I remember that letter. Yes, that was a beautiful letter, whatever. She said, meet me at the Algonquin. And I had no idea what the Algonquin was. So I managed to take the subway from Queens to Times Square, and I finally got there. And that's how we met.
Had you been reading Dorothy Parker in the New Yorker, you would have known.
Of course, then later, of course, I knew what you know, like the whole.
You were there. Yeah. So she began writing. She had a long career before she began writing at the New Yorker. She actually was on the sister station I just put down in the introduction, the Berkeley station, KPFA. She was a regular reviewer for them for a long time until one day she said, "This is my last show. I'm going to go somewhere where they pay me."
Yes.
And that concluded her effort at
but she had
the Berkeley station.
A voice made for radio. She had a very beautiful voice.
Yeah.
So I imagine that it was perfect for radio listeners.
And what she did really was try to make her, she followed her own voice in writing. She tried to make, she realized she was good on the air. And she tried to write not in an academic way or in a critical, even any known critical way, but in the sound of her own voice.
I think the way to maybe it's like she spoke in the American voice. You know, it was sort of like the voice of writers that she loved so much, like Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very slangy and very colloquial and very free-flowing, and it was that kind of thing.
It's odd for us now in a way, which, and I hope to do it, to kind of in a way review this documentary, because it's rare to see a documentary about someone. One leaves the film with mixed feelings about her because she got into so many scuffles with other rather famous figures, such as other writers, other film critics. Renata Adler wrote a famously awful critical piece about her in the New York Review of Books. And I think, didn't Veronica Gang write a poem mocking Pauline Kael?
Veronica wrote a satire, but what most people don't know is that Veronica and Pauline were really very good friends. After Veronica wrote the satire, Pauline called her. They were both at the New Yorker and said, "I love what you wrote. You know, like, it's really so good." And I just, you know, and so they met. And I went out with Veronica and Pauline many times to the movies together.
Oh, really? Wow. Me too. Actually, to hear jazz with Veronica.
Oh, yeah.
Well, she was a good friend.
Oh, yeah.
And she was hilarious, too. But I couldn't remember and I couldn't retrieve the sound of that parody of Pauline Kael, satire of Pauline Kael.
Yes. It was like everything that she wrote, very witty and, you know, and light and very incisive too, and she had some jabs there, you know, making fun of Pauline's exaggerations, but also there was admiration, and
right.
So Pauline saw that and they became good friends.
Because Veronica too attacked anything nearby, anything she felt was not quite perfect, really, and had a great ear for the fraud as did Pauline Kael. The other person she famously was at odds with was the famous Village Voice film critic.
Andrew Saris.
Andrew Saris. She was not a Sarisista, I guess you called him. And he had a bunch of followers in the film critic biz.
Yes.
And then were you aware when you met her after? That was her final book, wasn't it? The one you admired so much?
No, she wrote after.
She wrote more?
Into movies, she wrote
more than that?
I think like 11 more books or 9
more books. Oh, wow, no kidding.
Yes.
So she was. So how did you feel that this picture conveyed her? Was it a satisfactory to you as a participant in it?
Yes and no. I think it's very good for people who don't know about anything about Pauline Kael, the new generation, the young people who, you know, having read her, you know, it's kind of a history lesson about the movies in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then I think that, she was an extremely controversial person, and And she was, you know, sometimes she could be cruel, and she was, sometimes when she wrote one of her really cruel reviews or very and naughty reviews, I would call her and say, "Pauline, you're a wicked girl." And she would laugh and say, "Yeah, that's right, that's me." And she, I think she delighted in being the wicked girl in the classroom, that kind of, you know, person that, you know, saying, you know, like making, you know, fun of people and things, and, you know, things that she thought were pretentious or you know, and full of air and hot air. And so that's you know, part of, yeah, and that's certainly, they covered that in the movie. It didn't cover really a lot of, like, the private person, because I got to know her very well in private, and for many years I went to Great Barrington, where she lived with her daughter Gina James, and I spent 4th of July there, and then later in her life, many Thanksgivings with her and her daughter and her grandson, and sometimes Roy Blunt Jr. and a niece of hers. So I saw Pauline when she was not surrounded by film people and the critics and movie directors or movie stars or whatever, and then she was just a normal woman, very caring, loving, you know, like a grandmother, a sweet grandmother, who sometimes said very nasty things, you know. And then, yes.
She did say nasty things about people in conversation. Well, that's to be expected, really,
yeah.
Viewers.
She was like, she had a dirty mouth. Like, she would say, listen, she would not
say...
Don't
say the words.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Skip the words.
Yeah.
Don't say what she said. Say... translate.
Yes, well, she would not just say, let's get out of this place. She would say...
Okay. We get it. So, and was she... And when you went to the movies, did she...
Yes.
Did she... The film sort of suggests that she made a big racket in screenings, that she would grunt and groan and tap her feet and make a fuss if she did so,
no,
that you were all... Everyone was aware
sometimes
of what she...
she would laugh at things. Yeah. You know, but no. And no, I went to many private screenings with her. And, mm-hmm. I remember her laughter and, you know, sometimes sitting right next to a director and how uncomfortable they would get, and I would look at them and they, you know, they would just like sometimes get up and walk out because of something, there's something that Pauline was ridiculous in the movie or, you know, like that. But no, I don't think so. I don't think that's true. I think that when people are famous, many stories are, you know, told about them. And so, and they become sort of like the truth that everybody thinks they know, and but no, I don't think she was insulting to people like they say, certainly not at screenings.
Well, one of the interesting things, especially seeing it in a movie theater, seeing the film in a movie theater and not on Netflix, which is the way we see so many documentaries now or films altogether, is the. Is the power that she wielded really in those days, not only among readers of The New Yorker, but among Hollywood filmmakers. And you see the enormous change in the filmmaking business from the time that she, you know, shined her light on filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And now, when really there are so many critics, and everybody's a critic, really.
So many critics and no criticism.
And that's exactly a nifty point. So let's explore it. What does that mean, that everybody has an opinion but not a cultivated opinion like hers?
I don't know if I would call it cultivated. I think that what she had was... you know, I mean, first of all, that the movies doesn't really go into... Pauline had studied philosophy at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Philosophy?
Philosophy, huh. Yes. And also, she was, in math, she was considered a genius in logic because she had this, like, logic mind that, you know, like nothing I've ever seen. And there is a book of her correspondence with Robert Duncan, the poet, when they write... to each other about Marxism and politics back in the days at Berkeley, and was published by NYU a few years ago, a very small edition, and you know, it was like the letters of a political thinker. You know, she could really, mm-hmm. you know, they're talking about Marxism and Engels and this and that and the other, and communism, and you know, and so she was basically, that's what interested her at first, the philosophy. And then she, you know, she loved the movies, and she thought that she realized that she couldn't write about movies, you know, as a philosopher. She had to write about movies in the language of the movies, which is the language of the people, you know, the people, mm-hmm. you know, who saw the movies.
Right.
And so she, and that was her voice. It was not the voice of the philosopher that was really sounded a little bit artificial, but it was like the voice of, you know, like people talking.
Well, that was what was so interesting about her radio presence, is she had it in her that there was such a thing, in fact, as connecting the human voice to criticism. And by the way, this is Cat Radio Cafe, a radio show not that far and not far enough from the radio station Pauline Kael expounded on, one in Berkeley, California, another Pacifica station. I'm Janet Coleman talking to Jaime Manrique, the novelist and poet who appears in the documentary film, now playing at the Film Forum, What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael. Was she interested in your writing as much as you with hers?
Well, maybe not as much as me with hers, but she, because I, at that point when I met her, I was writing in Spanish. But we became really good friends when I published my first book in Colombia back in 1975, 6, 7, which was a collection of short pieces I had written on the movies, and I dedicated it to her. And so I sent her a copy, and she was so thrilled. But she said, but I cannot read it, whatever. You know, like, I want to read you in English. But it was several years before I could write in English. But she, once I started writing in English, she really took an interest in what I was doing. And always read things, and of course she was a very exacting critic, and she could say, you know, like, things that would devastate you or whatever, and things that really, when she praised you, it meant everything, because you knew that praise did not come easily.
Not easily.
So whatever, any word that she said that was praised, you know, you would live on that for years, you know, thinking about, oh, she liked that. So,
did she ever write on anything besides film?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, you know, no.
Because part of the running complaint in the film is hers about not earning enough money. She alternated with Penelope Juliet at the New Yorker, 6 months on, 6 months off. So she was without a gig, really, for 6 months. I'm assuming she wrote books in that time. But and what did she make money as a speaker or
as a speaker? And one thing I noticed is that there were always many scripts on her dining room table from movies that were being made or being considered. And so, you know, she was kind of a script doctor in the sense that she would read the scripts, and then she would talk to, like, the whoever has sent it to her. If she liked the person, she wouldn't do it with everybody. And I don't know, you know, people have suggested that perhaps they paid her. I don't know about that. I don't, you know, I don't. But anyway, I don't think it would have, colored her opinion. Or she would not have been like that. She was too ethical. But she did, I think she did. And later, you know, once she retired, she kept, I think she kept doing that for many years for different directors and, you know, Hollywood producers and, you know.
Well, she went to Hollywood herself for a time, too. She quit critical writing. She took a leave of absence or just quit the New Yorker. I can't remember which what the arrangement was.
Leave of absence.
Yes. She would be back maybe in 6 months. While she actually went to Hollywood, of course, everybody's radar went up on that one, that she went to some kind of a deal with Warren Beatty to actually produce and make a film, but she soon saw that being in Hollywood as a writer was not the same as being a writer in any other place, really. It was the most confining, the most restrictive, the most being bossed around, and the opposite of KPFA, that's for sure. And so she left. But it was somewhat scandalous. It was just because people were looking for gossip about her, hoping, wishing she would go down there? Go down in Hollywood, I mean.
Yes, I think so. Her enemies definitely were hoping that she would be a total failure in Hollywood. And in some ways she was, because she left, you know, after maybe a year there. And she couldn't take it. I mean, there was nothing about it that she liked. And so when she got back, I mean, that's when Renata Adler wrote that that the devastating piece criticizing Pauline.
Who did? Who wrote
Renata
this? Oh, Renata, yeah.
For the New York Review of Books.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the welcome back, Pauline.
The coup, so, the coup de grace.
Yeah.
And did she suffer because of this criticism, or was she resilient enough to not care after all?
I think she cared and she suffered, but she continued writing. You know, she continued writing. She didn't stop her from writing. At that point, she had become the only film critic at The New Yorker, so she kept writing for another 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That was like in 1982, 1981,
uh-huh.
And she was there until 1990, I think, another 10 years. But it, you know, her reputation, you know, took a hit, and many people, you know, dismissed her at that point and were nasty to her and stuff like that. But she, you know, she kept on writing, and by the end of her life, I think she had prevailed. You know, there were people who admired her very much, the young people who came to see her, young directors, and the scandal was like, yes, mentioned, but it didn't, you know, in any way, you know, shaped the course of her life or you know, no, or what she wrote.
Fascinating person, really. A lot of guts. Another thing the movie points out, the documentary, what she said, The Art of Pauline Kael, was how hard it is, really, to resist the movie industry as a critic. How it is such, to be an honest critic of film is very difficult because the publication is leaned upon, the editors are leaned upon, the writers, of course, are leaned upon, they're urged. I mean, they want a blurb, don't they? They want a blurb in the newspapers,
yes,
such as they are anymore. I mean, there aren't really newspaper blurbs to look forward to.
Or
I
newspapers
don't know.
For that.
Or newspapers, exactly. But in those days, that meant a lot. You couldn't easily, unless you really loved the film, as she did say, Last Tango in Paris. She was the first to come to the defense of it and really aided a lot of the young filmmakers who were coming up in that time.
All of them, Scorsese, Robert Altman, Francis Ford Coppola.
Right.
And, you know, that generation, really, she was the first one to write about them, David Lynch. She sort of produced Elephant Man when she was in Hollywood. That was the only thing that she really worked on that was made into a satisfactory movie.
Was that her choice? Is that what she wanted to do? She wanted to do that.
That. Yes.
That was a challenge.
Yeah. And so, she had the gift for seeing great talent. And like when people did something and it showed a spark of talent, you know, she would, you know, immediately recognize it, whereas most critics banned those movies when they came out and then later they realized they were dealing with great geniuses who were really making the best movies of that time.
Yeah. So how'd you like seeing yourself on screen? Yes.
I deserve an Academy Award.
I thought
I'm
so.
Waiting for the nomination.
That's why I had to have you on. I thought you
already prepared my speech.
I wanted to hear what else you had to say, and now we have heard a lot more.
Okay.
You were much more. I have a feeling when you perform for a documentary, they cut you at will. It's the same as being put on the cutting room floor.
It was. I think it was done at the worst moment in my life when that was filmed. I was going through something very dark, and my companion of many years had died, and I was like in the middle of a nervous breakdown. So I don't even know what happened there when I went there for that interview. So when I saw it, you know, for the first time in development, I was shocked.
You realized you could act.
Yeah,
act over
I'm
your
waiting
own
for a script.
Personal,
you know, like I can play anything.
It will come. Let that documentary get around a little. Maybe extend it. It was jam packed.
Yes, it was.
May be extended. It's so far now playing till, I believe, Thursday.
At
Film Forum till Thursday, January, second week
I think
of January.
It's extremely enjoyable.
Yeah.
And you know, and many people, you know, will, you know, find out, you know, who she was, people who don't know her.
Molly Haskell didn't like her, had very mixed feelings about her. She was the wife of Andrew Saras.
Yes, it's understandable,
Also a film critic.
Yes, it's understandable she didn't like it. And Pauline has so many enemies. I mean, and it was not like she didn't look for them. She was, you know, she could be very, you know, some very short with people, and so, like, you know, in a way she liked being confrontational. I think
yeah,
it was part of, you know, her dialectics or whatever. He was like, let's start an argument. And then she would like immediately look at, listen to what you say. And then if there was a flaw in it, she would attack it immediately, you know. And then I think that that was like in her nature. To always be a confrontational.
There's no indication of how that particular temperament emerged. What, how she came to that? Just that she.
It's the philosopher.
Philosophy background.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And logic. I mean, mm-hmm. she would take an argument when she wrote a review. She would say something in the beginning. It was the beginning of her argument. And then she spent the whole long review twisting that argument every which way until she had extracted every ounce of juice that it had. It was like that kind of mind of, you know, like, yeah. you know.
It's interesting because there was a litany of complaints that Renata Adler had about her quirks, you know, her foibles. Yeah. And among them was, well, she liked sexy movies. She liked
violent movies.
Violent movies.
Yes.
Did you go to a lot of those with her? Would she have liked, did she go to foreign movies?
Yes.
A lot?
Of course, yeah. I mean, she was a champion of Godard and
Truffaut and
De Sica and many of those great.
But not of Last Year at Marienbad.
No, she hated that.
She hated that. Really.
Well, because everybody loved it, so of course she was going to hate it. You know? She wanted to pick up a fight.
So she wasn't exactly wrong in what she hated.
No, it's unbearable. If I try to watch it now, I fall asleep every time I try to watch it. So what was I saying? I don't know what I was saying. You were saying something.
About Renata Adler's critiques of her foibles.
Well, Renata, you know, Pauline, before Renata wrote that, you know, I remember Pauline all the time when the subject of Renata came along, she would say, Renata's terrible. Renata's terrible. And then she found out how terrible Renata was. You know, they got back to Renata. You know, so she waited and waited.
Oh boy, the critical personality, quite dangerous.
Yes.
So go back to poetry. Write poetry, and somebody will send you a screenplay. I'm so delighted you could join us here, Jaime Manrique.
I'm delighted to be able to be here and talk with you again, and to, you know, talk about Pauline because I loved her. You know, I really did.
Because filmmakers, there wasn't enough of him in the film.
Yeah. Well, there was more of me than I thought there would be. So I was, you know, it was like interesting to see.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really talking about the reviews or anything. I was just talking about the person mostly.
So is Cervantes Street and all those novels of Jaime Manrique still about and available for everyone?
Yeah, they're in print.
Okay, get them because they're wonderful.
Yes, please get them. You'll get my autograph when I get the Oscar. So.
And you can call him as he called Pauline Kael.
I'm thanking my speech.
Have to take you out to dinner. Thank you so much, Jaime Manrique. It's a treasure to have you here.
Whatever. Thank you.
Craig Shepherd has a new program offering to you at the Music for Contemplation, it is called. Is that the Center for Music? Music for Contemplation, at which will be playing from January 6th, 7th, and 8th at the Domena Center. What's interesting about this piece, of course, is that it addresses the sex scandals in the Catholic Church. And the Center for Contemplation is something that you've been involved in as a musician and as a composer in trying to understand how to perform, I suppose, healing through music and through addressing issues that are painful. This one, of course, is a gigantic one, and this features this scandal in the Boston Catholic Church. And let's talk about your impulse. And it's been 5 years in the making, and it will be held, I guess it's tomorrow, the next night, the next night. So 6, 7, and 8. Talk a little bit about your impulse in creating and in working with the Center for Contemplative Music.
So I had heard the Bradley Manning, then or now Chelsea Manning. There was a sound file that was leaked from the courtroom of her talking about her torture. And I had heard that, and I thought, you know, it moved me so much, just the straight details, that I felt there wasn't much more that you would need to make a piece of music out of that. And I'd done a period of 91 days where I didn't initiate any new project, but I would write down all my ideas. And I met together with a number of musicians and music professionals. And we read through all the ideas. And at the end, Pauline Oliveros pointed to Broken Silence and said, this is the one. This is the one that you should do. So that began a long, slow process of doing tests. We did some closed workshops to see what the text might be and how the music might fit. And we have, over the 5 years, come to a program which I think works quite well.
Tell me a little bit about the ideas that were discarded. I mean, what were you looking for here in terms of conflict and resolution, in terms of, you know, resolving suffering and so forth? What public issues were you looking at to try to address musically?
I often work intuitively, mm-hmm. So I have to, when I get a clear yes.
Imagine.
Yeah.
You're a musician. You're not a sociologist.
But that means that I don't start out thinking in advance what I'm going to do. I see what is there and see what I might be able to do with it, which is, and so there, some of the other projects, actually, we have done them. One was a retreat, which we've done. Another one was just kind of pieces for a string quartet or for other instruments, a traditional concert. Another one was a book, which I didn't end up, about creativity, which I didn't end up going through with. And so what struck me about this piece was the strong resonance immediately. I mean, I had kind of thought there's something here. And this was in 2014 before, I mean, certainly a lot of the Boston Globe articles had come out and it was sort of in the awareness. But it was before this current round. It was before Me Too. It was before the Pennsylvania report from the diocese in Pennsylvania. The question, though, that I asked was, well, okay, so we're going to be listening to this really difficult material. How do you support people with that? How do you support people who are listening to this? And one of the things that influenced it was as some of the Me Too unfolded on social media, I had this feeling that it was really difficult to really process it. You'd read it in some of these accounts, and you'd just be really depressed.
Right. I mean, it's a door in the face, in a way. Yeah. It's hard to really step in and let it sink in. Yeah. I mean, I just saw that film called, what's it called, Bombshell, or the thing about Roger Ailes.
I heard about that one. I haven't seen it myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much. It's so horrific that you really can't believe that the whole world is running like this. But it is. I mean, all these great institutions are infected with all sorts of predation.
And that was one thing that really struck me, was that we do have this. It's across all our culture, this corruption is sort of endemic.
Yeah.
You name an institution and there's, you know, stories about corruption going on weekly, certainly. So the question then was, well, what can you do about it? And one of the things, and we work this way too, is, well, don't do it alone.
Uh-huh.
And when I would engage social media, it's just you and the screen. And so I found it really wasn't enough support to sort of take it in and to really see, really be present for the edges of it.
You mean you was the author of the project?
Well, that certainly. And one of the things that I decided early on and from the beginning was that I would never work on this thing alone. So right from the beginning, there were a team of excellent musicians mm-hmm. who we did the workshops with. Tony Jabal, Elisa Corona, Aaron Rodgers, were all there to continue, keep coming back and to still provide really valuable insight into even small details, how you move into the concert space, when, how long to wait in silence before the music begins, how long to wait in silence after the music ends. Huh. One decision that came from one of my music friends was that I actually should be outside greeting every single person that comes into the concert hall. And so that one decision then meant it was clear that I was there, that they, we were there together. It wasn't a, I'm coming from some kind of side door and into the concert
right,
space
right.
Or performing something that this separation between the performer and the audience, that we're all there together. So
well, are you a performer in this as well? You are instrumentalist. Yeah. You play what in the course of this?
So the
instruments are pretty interesting. Just listening to the possibilities from various types of saxophones. What other right. instruments? Unusual collection. Yeah.
So it's two saxophones.
Yeah.
And there it's also five steel string acoustic guitars. So uh-huh. regular acoustic guitar, yeah. but it's played with what's called an electronic bow. It's a set of magnets that vibrates the huh. string, and it creates a very pure huh. tone. And it's, sometimes you can't tell if you're listening to the guitar or listening to a saxophone. There's a huh. very ethereal quality to the sound. And I read the text. So the text came from Margaret Gallant, and she was writing to Bishop Medeiros.
Well, talk a little bit about that particular aspect of the scandal of the church. Margaret Gallant was who? A woman.
Yeah.
Unusually.
Yes, she was the grandmother and grandaunt uh-huh. of seven boys who were victims in a poor area outside Boston. And she had written to the cardinal to say, "Hey, this is going on." And the letter she writes is something that I found pretty early on. And again, it was one of these things where I saw this letter. I had such an immediate, strong response to Margaret's words that I felt pretty deeply moved. And so the letter itself alternates between her love for the church. Her family had been persecuted for love of the church. She had a lot of her respect for the cardinal comes across. And then it goes between that and her confusion and pain yeah. and anger. And when I read this letter, I thought, wait, this really is it. This she really goes through basically, it was a very strong beginning to the project. And so I read the text in the course of the performance.
You do read. You will read.
Yeah, uh-huh. yeah.
And how were you? I mean, how were you prepared as a composer? How were you prepared to be a reader, an actor?
So that was one of the decisions that we made too, because we did look at using professional actors. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions was that it was something. The text is so strong on its own that it doesn't need to be performed.
And just it, read. Just
yeah,
spoken.
And
unperformed.
Exactly. And
not easy.
Yeah.
It's harder than performing.
Yeah. So what I do is in part of the project is to pay attention to the energy level in the room to see where the musicians or especially the listeners might be with some of the material. And I might slow down to let them have more time to digest or metabolize, or uh-huh. sometimes it needs to speed up a little bit. So, hey, we've been enough here on this portion of the text, and now it's time to move on. There are also silences in the middle of the performance, sometimes up to 2 to 5 minutes, to just rest and say, okay, we've had this little chunk, we've had a couple paragraphs now, we're gonna rest and just be with it for a little while.
So this is very dependent on the audience response.
Exactly.
You really have it's a very sensitive Geiger counter you have to have within you to be able to judge how to move it, right? So you're conducting it as well.
Exactly, yeah. So I paste the text, and then I also conduct the entrances and the ends of the tones for the musicians.
Uh-huh. Well, the ends of the tones meaning when the sound stops?
Right, so you have really long chords. They're between 2 and 5 or 7 minutes long, and they build up very slowly, sometimes almost imperceptibly.
Uh-huh.
And then they end. And the ending of the tones is then also this this moment that happens in the piece. At the beginning of the project, I realized that I had a lot of responsibility as a musician, artist, composer. And so I looked into what modalities might be able to help me to be able to be prepared for the if listeners were having a hard time with the material. And I enrolled in a practitioner training for the Somatic Experiencing Institute, which addresses trauma.
Say what this is, the Somatic Experiencing?
Yes.
Meaning you re-experience in your body what has traumatized you?
Not necessarily re-experience. So somatic experiencing is a therapy modality which addresses all kinds of trauma, whether it be medical trauma, car accidents. The founder, Dr. Peter Levine, worked with NASA astronauts, but also sexual trauma. Developmental trauma is another one. And in taking the training, one of the things that came out, which there was a lot of synchronicity. And one of the things, they have this idea that you can pick up in the nervous system what's going on in somebody else's nervous system. So they call it resonance in the nervous system.
Huh.
And one of the practitioner's jobs is to really track what's going on to see where the client may be as they work through whatever the trauma is. And while this is not therapy, these are music performances, this idea of the resonance, being able to actually be sensitive to where somebody, the state that someone is.
Heavy duty, yeah.
Yeah.
So you, wait a minute, then you take this job on yourself to be the resonator.
Yeah.
You have to gauge the feelings of the audience. Collective or individual? I mean, how do you pick it up? Do you pick it up from individuals? Is there more, you know, more somatic activity coming from one or two areas in the audience? Or how do you gauge that?
That's an excellent question. The first part is there is something of a, for lack of a better word, a kind of heat or an incense. You might call it an atmosphere or a group vibe, for example. And so I look at the whole audience as one sort of nervous system. And you can kind of sense, we've done a number of test workshops with audiences before, and each one has had a distinct character to it. And a lot of the musicians have also noticed it. So we do a number of things to prepare ourselves. So the musicians are there, and we have some people doing a mindfulness practice in the room when the performance begins.
I want to remind everybody that this is Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman, and David Dozier is behind the board. And I'm talking to the composer Craig Shepherd about his music for contemplation. It's called Broken Silences. It'll be playing at the Domenis Center. We'll tell the specific details in a little bit in the next couple of days, which addresses the Broken Silence, addresses the sex scandal in the Catholic Church. And this is... what was the last sociological term you mentioned? It was after resonance. It's the one I stopped you on.
Oh, no, that's
now
okay.
I've forgotten what it is.
So you, so my job then is to pay attention to what the whole group vibe might be.
What the group vibe meant. Now, okay, now does that mean that the musicians have to also be equally sensitive? And what about their vibes?
So one of the amazing things about the musicians that we have Aaron Rodgers, Kristen McKeon, Dan Joseph, Dev Ray, and Alex Lahosky will be with us next week. They have, many of them have their own practice, and they've done four of these so far. So, and the whole team has been aware of the project. They've heard it. They've been through this experience. And
The experience of making the music and sharing it with an audience. Okay.
Right.
Sharing the...
Right.
The reverberation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so who do you anticipate comes to this? Are these people who have been traumatized? Will they be? I mean, who's in the audience? People who are just curious about the subject? Or people who are bringing some somatic agitation to it to begin with? Or people who are... And why are they in need of contemplation, the healing powers of contemplative music?
Well, we've had three basic categories of people who've attended the workshop performances. One where we've had priests, we've had survivors.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah.
We've had, actually, I would say four categories. We've had music connoisseurs, people who are just genuinely interested in the piece, and they've been very, very happy to be there. The other category were people who were not directly connected by this particular scandal, but were engaging with other abuses. So, and they actually, because they were one step removed, actually, I had the feeling that they actually got more out of it.
Why? Because it distanced their abuse from the one...
Something like
they
that.
They were listening to.
Yeah, something like that. Sometimes when you see somebody else... Or when the situation's outside of you, that you it's easy to detach from it, and to be there in the moment. We have had Catholic school board members. We've had CCD teachers. So we have had people within the church, and we're very happy for that. One of the things that we've noticed though is that people come and they often leave hopeful.
Yeah,
and I'm not exactly sure why. When I'm curious to find out this next week with the premiere, what the response is. My sense is it has something to do with being together with the others. That somehow sitting together in a group of people who have been through it and know the material, something about being together, you're able to expand your capacity to engage with this kind of material.
Now, as a composer, as an artist, this is a sort of outstanding question. We're in a pickle here with all of these institutional corruption scandals. Mm-hmm. Artists, I wonder from the point of view of the artist, is there more of an impulse to connect with an audience in a understanding that we all have a need to heal or we're all in trouble? Is there more need for an audience, for an artist to draw the audience in a different way and to impose this meditation process on the audience in hopes that something will change for both of you, us? You know what I'm saying? That we're in a traumatic period emotionally, I think, and that's my opinion. And it seems to me that you've been reaching into the petri dish of the culture for those moments of disturbance to be able to heal them, you know? Mm. Is there some change here in the way we're going to do art to use it as a healing process?
I don't know. It seems that art has, one of the functions of music has been healing. Certainly,
yeah, always,
certainly
right,
certainly
anyway.
Film has
right,
been.
Right. Yeah.
And the way we tell stories in theater. One of the things that I am specifically responding to is the isolation that people feel connected, you know, with their screens. So there's something about...
With their screens, yeah.
Yeah, so there's something about our communication on social media, which is actually
that's
not...
what I mean, yeah.
There's something missing from the connection there. So being there face-to-face...
No touching, for one thing.
Well, we don't touch in the performance,
but
you get the vibrations.
Yeah, that's the touch.
Well, this is true, yeah. So there's something about being together face-to-face with it, and we do strongly request that people either leave their devices at home or check them securely with the usher before they come into the performance space. And I think there is something about being together which we're going to recognize. I will say that I think that is – we're going to recognize – That's more important than we thought it was in the
absence of device. They could bring a charge to it anyway. Just the device itself has a buzz, a thing that goes on.
Yeah, it could. I I look at it from the standpoint of attention. Uh-huh. There's something about the devices which sucks the attention.
Right,
And there's something about the light of attention on this that has a positive effect.
Well, let's tell everyone. I didn't want to keep it a secret, but you are really fascinating on the topic as the mastermind of this project, even with all the help you're getting from the musicians and your co-meditators or contemplators. This is going to be performed at the Domena Center, which is at 450 West 37th Street at 8:25 p.m. What's the deal about 8:25? Why is that the time?
Well, doors open at 8, and though 8:25 is when the doors close. So it will unfortunately, because of the sensitivity of the subject matter, when people come late, it's a little
don't want to interrupt.
And it's a real interruption. It's not it's different than just missing the first tune on a rock concert.
Well, now that we know what the process is, we would understand better. It's free too. I did read that you have to make reservations in advance, but is how much in
That's
advance?
Right. We have limited seating.
You got a number?
A couple of the days we're about 2/3 full.
Okay.
So we do request RSVP, which is
at what number? Do you know?
So you would send an email to there's an RSVP link on the Music for Contemplation website, or you can send an email to info@mufoco.net.
Want to say that once more?
info@mufoco.net.
Okay.
So info@mufoco.net. And that's how to RSVP. And we don't necessarily, you don't even need to give the names of everybody that's coming, just the number.
Just the number
so
of people.
So that we have to, because we do have a limited number of seats.
Well, it sounds like kind of a life-changing concert to see what it's like to be part of a rehabilitation process without one's even really being aware of it.
It has actually, working on this has changed me.
You.
And which I didn't realize in the beginning, it's actually increased my hope.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually much more hopeful now, having done this a couple of times and working on this project, than I was when I began.
So we can call you Dr. Craig Shepherd.
No. I've done some postgraduate
music work. Shrinks.
No, and that's also something to be clear about. This is not therapy, and I am not a trained therapist.
Right.
So when people come, we have found it to be helpful in healing, but and we are happy to give recommendations for people who are looking for more help, but this is actually not a therapy session.
So don't, it's not over. Right. Go home. They're not coming back for you. Thank you.
Thank you so much,
Craig Shepherd, for this explanation of why we want to go see this. Yeah. We do. Thanks.
Thank you, Jenna. It's great to be here.
Yes.
Johnny come lately.
listening to Jackie and Roy sing the tune by Roy and Fran Landisman, Through the Windows of Cars.
You can say whatever.
You asked me to come here.
I want you to help me write my will.
How may I help?
Well, how does it begin?
I believe you state your name and that you are of sound mind.
Do I have to prove that?
No, just say so.
And then what?
You say how you want your estate divided.
I don't have an estate.
A living person does not have an estate, but there is estate planning.
You mean for when I will have an estate?
When you are no longer a living person.
Like before I was born.
Yes, but before you were born, you didn't have a name.
And I wasn't of sound mind.
Any other questions?
Who should I leave my money to?
Your spouse, children, brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, grandchildren, favorite charities.
Ooh, like a radio station?
A listener-sponsored radio station.
Good. I want to leave the bulk of my estate to radio station WBAI. What do I care? I'll be dead anyway.
Right. Stay tuned to WBAI New York for the next hour of Cat Radio Cafe.
To hear the two of us,
Janet and David,
with David Finkel and Alpha Betty Olson, discuss
gigs.
Recorded live at Cabaret Pangea on 2nd Avenue in the Bohemian East Village.
After our show, stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa, and tomorrow night at this time, Reggie Johnson stirs the pot on From the Soundboard. Stay tuned. The next hour of Cat Radio Cafe here from WBAI New York.
This week recorded live at Cabaret Pangea,
where the specialty of the house is organic spaghetti.
Bon appetit.
L'chaim. I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. On this show, we will be joined by compulsive writer and songsmith David Finkel and Norwegian comedy goddess Alpha Betty Olsen to discuss gigs. Gigs. Gigs means work, right? But it's not exactly a job. It's like a gig. What Anybody volunteer to do?
Well, it's like an odd job that happens maybe once. It's some special kind of little job you do. Or mainly it's jazz musicians were being employed here and there, and those were gigs that they went out on. Then we decided any little job you do could be considered a gig.
Like a one-night stand is really the sort
of those kind
of
one-nighters, yeah.
A musician would have a... Or a good job.
I had a weekly job.
They don't have regular jobs.
I didn't think it was a gig, but it was.
What was it?
Mowing the lawn. And I got a dollar.
And it didn't last.
And I kept complaining to my employer, my father, that the lawnmower that he had inherited from his family was rusty and it was very hard to push.
Yeah.
And tough luck, kid.
So I
get out there and push it.
Well, you quit. I'm sure you quit other gigs on your own volition, right? You couldn't exactly quit that one.
No, that one was hard to quit.
Involuntary.
In fact, what we did was we moved. This was a place where we had a quarter acre of lawn, and we moved out of that place into a smaller backyard, and that was easier to mow. But the neighbor had a lawnmower that was like butter. It just was, you could push it with a finger. It was so easy to roll around. And again, Dad brought along his old lawnmower. It was really hard to push. But now I'm really glad because my arms are strong and I can push a lawnmower if I have to.
If anybody needs a lawnmower, then I guess that would be you, right? Okay,
now,
so
now I have moved, you know, I haven't had a lawn. I don't have a lawn. I
mean, well, I'm sorry.
There's a backyard where
others
we live.
Do. You don't have to. You could do someone else's lawn.
Do you? Yes, exactly.
No.
That is really the nature of the gig.
That's right.
Doing your own lawn, I
sure.
think, at this point would not be a gig.
No, it's
be
a
just,
chore.
Yeah.
It's a chore.
But this makes me think of, I guess, at my first gigs, the first thing I earned money for was babysitting.
Right. That's a gig.
Yeah, and I had many gigs for a couple of years there because we lived in this. Housing development, and my parents were friendly with all these people that were having kids. They would all go out. The parents would go out. I was the one that was
old enough
on hand to babysit.
How much did you get? 50 cents an hour?
I don't. I may have gotten as much as 50 cents an hour, but I think it was probably more like a quarter an hour.
Really? That is cheap.
Yeah,
work.
So
that
I would work for 4 or 5 hours, and I'd get to. Sometimes it was hard, sometimes it wasn't. If the kids went right to bed,
right.
You just sat there watching television. Or
right, it's
something.
A gamble with babysitting.
Yeah.
Right? Did the kid. If the kids. How old were the kids?
The
more
kids
than one
were,
of them?
Frequently there were two or three. And,
wow, that's a handful.
It could be a handful. And I guess I was all right at it because nobody ever complained.
It is odd, though, that adults would trust another child with the lives of, say, three children. Would you have a phone number on hand?
Yeah, sure. You always, had a phone number.
Did you ever call the police or anything?
No. I think I probably did have occasion to call the parents who were at a restaurant or something. And... but it was okay. And also, they would stock the... They'd say, whatever's in the refrigerator, you can have.
Uh-huh.
So I availed myself of that. So that was in addition to the quarter an hour.
I was a bonded babysitter.
Bonded? What's that?
Meant I had no criminal record. And and if you were staying, let's say, at the Pierre Hotel, and you wanted to go to the theater, but you had a child with you, I would be your babysitter.
Whoa, you must have applied for that bonding thing, huh?
I don't even remember how
you were a go-getter.
Well, no one ever checked it. It was a
no
word.
One cared.
It was a word. I don't think it was ever a reality.
So did you advertise in the Hotel Pierre bonded babysitter?
No, there was a woman who ran the babysitting service for hotels in New York.
Whoa.
And I worked for her.
I'm impressed with this because obviously you put some, pedal to the metal in trying to find out how to be an official babysitter as opposed to just wait for, the neighbors to go to a restaurant.
Well, I don't remember how I got involved with it in the first place. But
it shows some of your intelligence, I think.
Well, I had a full-time job, but it didn't pay that much, which is why I picked up on the babysitting gig.
You were full-time. How old were you at the time?
Not that old.
And had a full-time job? Were you?
Yeah, well, I got out of high school. I just turned 17. Uh-huh. And my parents said, you can't go away to school. You're too young. Uh-huh. So I said, then I won't go anywhere. And I got a full-time job.
Do you remember what the job was?
Yeah, I worked for Teachers Annuity and Insurance Company of America. And my job was when people paid their premiums, they mailed it in, and me and another, a woman, an older woman, and we opened the envelopes, and then we looked at the checks to make sure that they were filled out correctly. And then ultimately we put together the deposit and went to the bank.
And you did this 5 days a week?
Yeah.
From 9 to 5 and an hour for lunch?
Yeah.
What? And how many months could you endure that?
It was nice because ultimately it qualified me for unemployment insurance.
Huh. Well, that's a gig. That qualifies it as a gig, don't you think, if you get fired and get unemployment insurance? My mother used to have gigs like that. She would work at, she worked on Division Street. On weekends, through the season, the winter coat season. And then they would give the girls who did were the saleswomen. Division Street was the lower East Side, which I think everybody who then worked in these stores, Levine and Smith and Brenner Brothers, they would die to see what the neighborhood was like now. It would be unrecognizable. In fact, Division Street is it's just a sign, I think. But anyway, she would get laid off every summer and have to go to unemployment insurance, and preferred unemployment insurance, but would have to go out to look for gigs, you know, for other jobs. And so she would get jobs at other department stores selling coats, which was her specialty. And she would be really good at the job. And it was a conflict with her whether to keep how to get fired from the job so she could go home again and collect unemployment insurance.
How did she get fired?
She couldn't get fired thing. She, because her pride also got in the way. She had to be good and sell more coats than anyone else. So she often was gone, you know. I was a latchkey kid as a result of this.
So gigs
her excellence as a gigster.
Gigs could extend.
Yeah, they definitely could. You sometimes would take a job. We had a gig together, in fact. It was the same place. It was similar to Alphabetti's job.
Well, if you're looking at me, Janet Coleman, David Dozer here.
That's what I mean.
What job did we have?
We had a job with a guy. He was some kind of insurance fraudster, I think.
Oh,
we were
yeah.
cleaning up the computer records. It took a long time for that to become
clear. He was
clear.
Some kind of doctor who the insurance people were after him for what did you actually do for this patient.
Right.
So we had to go back into all his patients' records and add.
And rewrite them.
And rewrite his records, what he did.
And he was paying a handsome fee.
Yeah, because he was in trouble.
That's right.
He needed help.
Well, wait a minute.
I had a gig the day I got my Social Security card. I was 17.
What was the gig?
I was at a carnival, and that day I had gotten my Social Security card, and they announced at the end of the carnival, anyone here with a Social Security card can help us dismantle the Ferris wheel. We'll pay you $10 in a spaghetti dinner. And so a bunch of us had Social Security cards. Mine was brand new. And,
Did you have to show it to prove?
Yeah, definitely.
You were only about what? How old? 16?
I was 17. I was pushing 18. I was about to be 18. Uh-huh. And anyway, we all got this job, and we had the straw boss was up there, and he said, okay, gang, now we all grab this part of this Ferris wheel, and we lifted it up, and suddenly the guy is screaming, and he fell over, and we broke his arm.
Ouch.
And they said, okay, everybody, here's your spaghetti dinner, your $10, and get out of here. And so
they left town? The carnival broke up?
Well, the carnival moved on, yes.
Did the guy with the broken arm get insurance?
He worked, probably.
He went to another carnival.
He was the carnival. He worked for them. We were all the people, were just employed on the spot, and we managed to break the guy's arm. We didn't mean to, I don't believe. It just happened.
Now, does that count as your first gig in show business?
It's my first Social Security job, anyway.
But is it,
working at a carnival, that's show business, that's right. It's like being on a stage crew.
Did you put it on your resume?
I don't think I did.
Do you remember your first gig in show business? Silence.
I worked. Wait a minute. No.
Not as impressive as those typing jobs.
I worked for a Broadway producer. Arthur Kanter, and he was also a Broadway press agent, and we shared the same office, and that was, and on my phone, I could pick up and listen to all of his phone calls, because he always wanted a witness.
Wow. He was like the insurance doctor in his own way, wasn't he?
Right.
And so who'd you hear? Did you hear, like, famous people? Or
Jack Schlissel from David Merrick's office all the time. They were very good friends. And all the Broadway gossip. It was great. It was terrific.
And that was 5 days a week, hour for lunch? Or was it hours different because it was show business?
Well,
to 6 rather than 9 to 5.
Probably. It was kind of loose in terms, and the 6. Sometimes it would be 7, you know. I also worked for...
That's a job, isn't it?
I also worked for Robert L. Joseph, and he had produced some shows on Broadway, and then he was being a writer when I worked for him, and for television, and he would keep me working very, very late, and then he'd take me to dinner at Sardi's.
That's not a bad...
So that was pretty nice.
Does that count as a gig or a job?
That was a job.
Okay.
That was really a job, yeah.
But didn't you have one-offs?
Well, with Marshall Efron,
right. We
reviewed restaurants for the Soho Weekly News, and the paper arranged for the restaurant, so the restaurant knew we were coming.
And the only
pay we got was a free meal once a week.
It seemed worth it, though, at the time, right?
Right. Well, I do remember standing, you know, waiting to be seated, and I looked down at the reservation book, and on the top of the page, it said Brooklyn phone booth, and there was a telephone number. It was an Italian restaurant, and I said to Marshall, we're going to give this place a good review.
Do you remember the name of it?
No.
It's not here any longer, huh?
Not here any longer.
None of those are.
Right.
Very few of them left.
Right.
With white tablecloths?
Yes.
Right. But they didn't care about the white spaghetti sauce on the tablecloths miraculously. Why not? Why not? Because someone had a laundromat right nearby.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Don't they usually rent it?
If you throw salt, you throw salt on it.
Throw salt immediately on the tomato sauce?
Yeah, does it.
I didn't know that.
Oh, that's good to know.
I'm going to go out and have some spaghetti immediately.
Bring your salt.
Marshall and I had a job. We were in Italy rewriting a movie.
That's a
and
good gig.
And we were in a 16th century building in the restaurant. Mm. And facing us at the table was one of the producers who was suffering intense jet lag. He didn't know where he was because he'd been flying back and forth too much. And then suddenly the floor under my feet kind of danced. And I looked at Marshall, and he said, this is an earthquake. And he said, if you see any cracks in the wall, run for the piazza.
And did you have to?
No, all the waiters ran and stood at the door. And we figured that they were saving their life, but also...
But not yours.
They didn't want us to run away and not pay the bill.
That makes sense.
I've talked about the first money I earned for gigs, and the second time, I was brought up in Trenton, New Jersey, and which was the state capital. So, and my father was a very good physician, and one of his patients was the head of the state library in the state house, and when we were all 16, we could get our working papers. So when I was 16, I worked in the state library, and that was a gig for the summer. And then subsequently, I worked for the Department of Agriculture one summer, the Department of Highways one summer, the Department of Vital Statistics one summer. And those were great gigs.
They are. I had a gig like that, a summer job, really, right?
Yeah.
Where you're still in high school. I can't remember whether it was in high school or college, but the one skill I had was typing. And it was a care. And I don't know why they said yes, but, and I can't remember what the salary was. It could have been as high as could it have been $80 a week? Does that make sense? A typist?
Wow.
No, probably system more like $65 a week. And it was intense typing, morning till night. But the people who did the job at CARE, they did this as a job.
Did you?
This was their life. They
how many
came
words
in,
a minute could you do?
Oh, I suppose at that point about 90.
Wonder
if you do that every day. Now I don't think I can get my fingers to move that fast. You type very fast too, David Dozer, right?
Yeah.
Were you not a fast typist?
No, I taught myself typing.
Because usually writers...
I'm still not good.
Really?
I have to do a lot of typing over. In the old days, when we had to white out, it was really a problem.
Yeah. Why, you had a lot of white outs on your...
Oh, constantly.
Well, you can't do that.
Now you can make a nice correction on a computer, but...
At CARE, I remember you had to be pretty perfect. And
I remember
the woman I worked with, Tessie, who was really like Working Girl in Staten Island. I think she was from Staten Island. I don't know where we would go out, that seemed to me, to get takeout. You wouldn't have really time to take an hour for lunch and buy makeup, too. You know, whatever you did in your hour. It was an hour. Anyway, it was lucky I could get a job.
The man who only lives for making money lives a life that isn't necessarily sunny. Likewise, the man who works for fame, there's no guarantee that time won't erase his name. The fact is, the only work that really brings enjoyment is the kind that is for girl and boy meant. Fall in love, you won't regret it. That's the best work of all if you can get it. Holding hands at midnight, 'neath a starry sky. You can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the door, where two hearts become one, who could ask for anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it,
Ella Fitzgerald and the George Gershwin Songbook. Nelson Riddle and his orchestra. It's not really about work, is it?
No, but people will say that if you're in a marriage or something, you need to work at it.
Work at it. I guess that's how it...
Work.
So once you take that vow, you got to work at it.
Yeah, right, sure. I never did understand that. What does it mean you got to work at it? Now I'll do the dishes or come up with schemes for who takes over different chores. Is that working on a relationship? Or is it always discussing your inner life with the other person? Anybody have any ideas?
I think you have to work on ignoring the other things that you might argue about.
Right. That's not really work, is it?
Well, it's kind of work.
That would be considered work, I think, yeah.
So now we were talking, I mean, these are random jobs that came up in the first act of this exploration of gigs here on the next hour of Cat Radio Cafe at WBAI. What am I saying? New York, WBAI New York, here at Pangea. Is that when you start getting a job for money, it's often not related to the work you're going to do in your later life. But when you focus in on something that you want to do for whatever, you want to do it. You want to be a writer, you want to be a this or that. And I don't know, a doctor. I haven't ever wanted to be a doctor, but I'm sure there's certain things you could do, like take care of animals, or I don't know, or babysit for children who have just broken their arms. I'm not really sure how you would direct yourself if you had ambitions to be a doctor. But if you had ambitions to do anything, you would take a gig, more likely. You would take anything that led to a future job, isn't that right, in your field? Wouldn't you just like do anything?
What do you mean by anything?
Well, I don't mean quite the story of the guy at the circus with the elephant, but like, which I can't tell in any discreet way, but stuff that's humble. Humble jobs because they were in show business or they were... You know what I'm talking about? No.
I think I know what you're saying, because you might take jobs where you thought, I'll take an entry-level job.
That's what because I'm thinking
of, entry-level. I might be able to move up the ladder. And sometimes that worked and sometimes they didn't. You stayed at the entry level for quite a while until you realized
that there wasn't a way up.
There was no next run on that ladder.
Give an example of such a job.
I don't know whether I've ever taken a job like that. My first job in New York, what turned out to be a great job. I came to New York after I graduated from college, and the first job I got was at a trade magazine in the music business. And because it was the music business, it was regarded as a gig anyway.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And it turned out I got the job in October of 1962, and I was there for 10 years, and the 60s were maybe the most exciting period, aside from the 20s, I would say, in the music business.
Yep. Uh-huh.
So it was a great gig. It was one I didn't necessarily want to leave, although I thought maybe if I want to be a writer and I want to be a different part of the music business, maybe I should leave it, but I just didn't want to. It was so great.
So great.
I love that gig.
Did they advance you at all in what you were doing?
Yes and no. I was advanced in a different way. When I got the job at this magazine, there were three of us on the staff, and then they were bought out. The magazine was called Music Vendor, and we were bought out about a year and a half after I worked there by two guys who had left Cashbox, where they'd been for years, to start their own. They didn't want to be there anymore. They wanted to start their own magazine. They bought ours because it was starting up in a way. And then they just added people and kept us in our positions, but added a lot of people under us.
Ah, so you're big shots.
So we turned it, medium shots maybe. But it was a great time. I was at everything.
I had a job. It wasn't a summer job, but it was one of these where, what do you call it, a lowest entry job where they give you, I got a 2-week gig, this is a gig, 2 weeks working, and it was because my parents' friends had a friend in the newspaper business who knew someone at True Romance. And they knew I wanted to be a writer, so they gave me, I think it was, a two-week job editing letters to the editor of True Romance. And these were the worst written letters you could possibly imagine. It was a lesson in how not to write, you know. And it was people in true despair with horrible situations in their lives. But they wanted somehow, they were reaching out to True Romance because those stories were all about people in horrible pickles. And they were reaching out to True Romance to help, really. And I was ruthless, I think, as an editorial. This one's get out, no good.
Did you rewrite them? You just threw them out, or you rewrote them?
I think I must have had the liberty to rewrite them because they couldn't go in as is. Mm-hmm. They were tragedies, though, and that made me say never want to write stories for True Romance. Mm-hmm. I had this feeling of superiority, which I don't respect in myself. I was sort of started out like a little snob, you know?
How did you get the true stories that you were writing?
I wasn't writing true stories. These were letters to the editor that would be published.
No, but I'm asking about the magazine because it's...
Oh, how did they get the true stories?
Yes.
For some reason, that was not allowed in this job, that I wasn't allowed to meet the actual writers of the true romances. They didn't give you any lessons in how to write the stories, which would be, I think, the secret to learning, to having a really first-line experience as a writer. Wouldn't that be about the bottom rung of learning to be a writer, writing a true romance?
Well, they had to be true.
No, they didn't. I don't think so. The letters to the editor were true, but the articles?
That's very nice of you to think that.
What, that they were true?
That they were true stories.
Yeah, sucker.
And those letters were probably truer, but they weren't such, the romance wasn't so wonderful.
In a way, it's funny, in a way, that job hooked up with a job, another gig I had, which I don't think even lasted 2 weeks, was as a typist for Sheila Graham. The gossip columnist, do you remember her?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
She was the girlfriend of Scott Fitzgerald, and that was what she sort of made her dined out on, or wrote books about for the next, after she stopped being a columnist, wrote books, Beloved Infidel, what was a Babylon thing that used to be in Hollywood?
Oh, it's called Hollywood Babylon?
Not Hollywood Babylon, but the
Garden of Allah.
Garden of Allah, sorry. Oh. College of One. She had a series of books that involved Scott Fitzgerald, and she was writing, I think it was College of One that I was working on as a typist. And she would lie in bed all made up, and she was very rude. She was... the maid offered me cookies and I ate them, and she held that against me at the end of the job when she was firing me. But it was something I said to her. She was talking about the great critic Edmund Wilson, who had gone to Princeton with Scott Fitzgerald, and she said, and then Edmund Wilson drew a deep breath. Poor dear, it was to be one of his last. He died a year later. And I said, Miss Graham, do you think that this sentiment here is exactly in good taste? And she stewed on that for a few days, I guess, before she fired me. That was too rude. To criticize her writing was not part of my job. And she was right, of course.
Yeah, I was fired also.
A little too outspoken.
By being too rude to Elaine May, actually. We were in the thing called the third year, the first day of rehearsal, and Elaine announced that she wanted to get Jackie Kennedy, for crawling out of the limo when her husband was being assassinated. And I said, Elaine, do you think this is in good taste to go after Jackie? And that evening I was fired. So I believe it's a good idea not to tell the boss that something is in bad taste. Just say, yeah, that's good. Yeah, Edmund Wilson's the last breath. Well, I like that a lot. Oh, attack Jackie Kennedy? Sure, why not?
I'll do it.
Yeah, give me some rocks, I'll throw them. Yeah. Dope. Don't tell people they're in bad taste. right?
Yeah, I once had a gig I quit. It was to be in a movie, too. I didn't think the
I didn't think it was in good taste.
No, I wasn't. And you continued
You were more a true romance writer at the time.
That's what I believed in.
You didn't feel it was true romance, the part they asked you to play.
Truly snotty snob. And I'm not sure where that came from, you know? Were you a snob about work? No, you were a hard worker, Alpha Betty.
Well.
Were you a snob?
Probably. Probably.
Secret
but I worked, I was the person at the, on the typewriter when Mel Brooks and, when they were writing Get Smart, and Mel Brooks and Buck Henry.
Sitting around there.
And I'll just say this, whoever controls the typewriter controls what goes on paper.
Yeah, sure.
You have a lot of power.
That's right, because they don't remember what they said, right?
Right.
So you were writing all, were you writing Get Smart?
No, no, just, this was the pilot. Mm. And,
okay, these are lessons for all the teens that are listening. One, don't tell your boss that he does anything in bad taste, he or she. And two, whoever is at the typewriter
controls what goes on paper.
Right, okay, David, you'll have to come up with one of those now.
A lesson you learned
from a lowly, stupid mistake in your work, gig life.
Oh, I can give you that very easily. Because frequently I would be so happy to take a job that I would be glad to take less money. And what I learned was that people treat you in direct proportion to how much they're paying you.
Yeah.
If you're doing a job for little money because you think this is going to get me inside, you're going to be treated like you're expendable.
So not if you work for this woman.
I love you guys. I'm sure it's no surprise that I do. I love your sound, your swing. Love that thing you bring to the most well-worn song. To make us want to hear it all night long. To make us want it to go on all night long. To death, I love you guys. Hearing you improvise lays me flat. I love your twos, your fours. Love the way you blew the door. Wish I could show you guys how much I care. Put $1 million in your pension and welfare. For those years you spent developing your knack. In the hopes that you would someday wind up on some soundtrack where you're not even heard. That's a little absurd. Oh God, I love you guys. You're heroes in my eyes, for real. I love to watch you go to town. I'll never tell you to turn it down. Cause I love you guys. That's the deal. I'd like to take a moment to apologize to you guys for any lapse in my musicality. Scatting the blues over non-blues tonality. Accidentally changing key, then looking around at you furiously. We often struggle with insecurity. Especially those of us who don't play. That would never apply to Miss Carmen McRae. And I'm sorry that we had nothing to do with me. Four times along the way, when you fell prey to some awful indignity. Being made to her magic best, being told the nuts are for the guests. So bad I love you guys, to hear you cracking wise is a treat. I love your early takes and your final takes, the alleged mistakes that you insist require punching in. I never noticed them and never could begin to say how I adore you guys. I'd do anything for you guys and your long-suffering families. Remember to thank them, please. Love how you go straight ahead. It especially knocks me down.
dated a ton of you, married one of you. His license plate is a seven-stroke roll.
That's Greg demonstrating. It goes right, right, left, right, right, left. I kind of explain it in the booklet.
I love you guys, heart and soul.
Super brilliant, Lorraine Feather. I love you guys from her album Attachment. Bob, that's up your alley. Now, is it true that musicians, if they work for less, that's not always true that that's the, that people treat you worst, right? Musicians do play for a little love of the music, don't they?
Depends.
Yeah, okay.
I worked with Lester Lennon's band, and those guys were definitely in it for the money because they hated Lester. And they said they hated music too. They'd gotten so hardened and disillusioned.
But it was always one thing to play for Lester Lennon and another to dance to Lester Lennon.
Well, it was a great dance band in a way, you know, if you wanted to do society dancing. And they were in fact remarkable musicians. They had a repertoire of, I don't know, thousands of tunes that they would play by memory, and they would harmonize them by memory. There was no music. The first time I played with them, for about a half hour, I was just trying to find out where I fit in, and fortunately I was able to do it. Huh. But that was a wild gig in its way, and their attitude towards Lester was something to behold.
Well, did he know it?
Probably.
What was so bad about him?
Well, It was the way that he would be all obsequious to the clients and the guests, and then he would turn around and glare at the band.
Oh, yeah.
He was not pleasant that way.
Sounds like Alan Funt was a similar.
Hey.
Yeah. And then he would turn back and be obsequious to a client while the lead alto would stand up and play into his ass. It was really something.
But you mentioned Alan Funt.
Yeah, I mentioned him because he was a similar nasty employer. The job you ever got for Alan Funt really was only a short gig, right?
Yeah, he guaranteed a week. I had a job with Candid Camera, and we were given a one-week guarantee, yeah. And the writer right before me was Joan Rivers, and because I found her notes in the desk, and she had been fired after her week.
So you didn't use her jokes?
No, I didn't use her jokes because he shot them down. You had a meeting every end of the day with Alan, and you told him an idea. If he didn't like it, you better not bring it up again. So, in fact, I did bring it up again. I said to him, Alan, I would like to tell you why I think this idea will work. And he said, David, this is not a democracy. I said, okay, that's it. Well, you do not argue about an idea with him.
I worked for Alan Funt.
Uh-huh,
you did? How many weeks?
Well, it was a fairly decent job. He had just made a movie, and it was all pieces. And it was my job was to try and put the pieces in an order that made some kind of sense.
Yeah.
I would sit in his office, and he would tell me stories. He told me very interesting things.
Yeah.
He said when they were going to record, and he had a group of people, he would talk to them ahead of time, and because he had in mind what he wanted them to tell him. And he would use that as part of the conversation. And he said that then when they turned it on and they started, they really repeated it. It really worked. And they didn't know they were being groomed. You know, it was it was interesting.
Well, maybe we should tell the listeners here who are probably only around 13 or 14 years old, listening to the radio under the covers, who Alan Funt was.
Well, go ahead and tell.
He was the...
Well, he was a producer of a radio show that turned into a TV show called Candid Microphone, and then on television was called Candid Camera, where people didn't know they were being photographed in some situation where, as he explained to me, he was tired of making fun of people week after week and entrapping people and making them look stupid. He wanted to do something better than that. But once you get on the job, you realize the job was to make people look stupid so you could laugh at them for being morons who didn't know they were being televised. And it was impossible to do the show the way he thought he should do it.
Which was
to ruin his show. which was making fun of stupid people.
But everybody who would be likely to work for him, writers or performers, knew how terrible he was and knew that if they took the job, they would only be there. People counted on
right.
him being there from...
And yeah. getting unemployment after and, that,
and
right?
The one, well. The one person who did work somehow well with him was Fannie Flagg, and she kept that
she
job
did.
For a long time.
Sure.
What was the miracle? Was she his girlfriend?
Kirby was a sidekick.
I don't know what the what. I knew Fanny at the beginning of her career when she was performing before she became a novelist, a good novelist, and she was just a terribly nice person and clever and smart. But that so were so many of the other people that worked for him, and I don't know what the difference was between her and everybody else that was there for a week or two. But it was he was well known. It was really around town to people.
Well, did Lester Lennon have that sort of a reputation, or did he keep his music? How did you even, Bob, all get into the Lester Lennon band? Was it something like the way comedy writers worked for... Alan Funt?
It's all who you know. And in this case, Bob McCoy, who I had studied trumpet with, who had been lead trumpet on the Tonight Show Band in New York and stuff like that, mm-hmm. he worked for Lester Lennon for a while in his office as an administrative type. And so he recommended me.
Huh? Oh, and were you one of a kind, a loose extra, or did they often have fill-ins?
I was
because people quit or he fired them.
If they had jobs that only used two trumpets, I was not included. But if they used three, I was the third guy. And this continued for about a year.
Well, that's a long-running gig. I mean, these are almost as good as your. What's the name of that music magazine you were with?
It was Music Vendor, and then it became Record World.
Music Vendor, Record World.
But one thing I'll say for Alan Funt. And I always excuse everything I know about him working with people I knew or knew about, is that my father thought that Candid Camera was the funniest show on television.
And it was.
And I'd watch it with my father, and he would break up laughing at everything on that show. He just loved it. My father needed to be amused because he worked so hard.
Yeah.
And so I was always grateful to Alan Funt for that.
So
good for Fannie Flagg for figuring it out, whatever she figured right. out.
So you didn't have to come up with Alphabet. You just did stuff in the office. You didn't
right.
work with other comedy writers or
no.
And you worked
was,
in the same room.
It had already been filmed. The movie had already been filmed.
Right.
But it was about trying to figure out what kind of an order the sketches would go in that would make it possible to sit through in a movie theater. So.
Have we ever heard of this movie, Candid Camera? Was it called Candid Camera or Candid Movie?
Yeah, it was called something else, but it didn't really get a lot of notice, and I don't think it was in theaters very long.
But he did hang on there for a very long time, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Offering gigs
because
to...
Because he hired so many writers that the one after the other, it was a credit, and then you're at an agency like whatever they used to be called. The
William Morris.
Well, it wasn't them, but anyway, whoever they were, and then they got you other gigs... like writing comedy sketches for comedy acts and things.
Right.
And that's where how I got to work for Daisy Lewis and Mr. Igor, Mr. Igor being a chimpanzee. So I wrote scenes for Daisy Lewis and her chimpanzee
where
he played her husband, he played her drummer in a band, he played
her
psychiatrist, he played a judge at the Miss America pageant, and they complimented, said most people we hire as writers, they just come up with a bunch of banana jokes, and you didn't. So congratulations to you. You wrote a chimpanzee as if he was a person, and I did. And I'd like to tell everyone now that all chimpanzees that work in show business are females. The males are too strong. So J. Brett Mungs was a female. Mr. Igor was a female.
Was a female. And let me tell you.
You cannot work with a male chimpanzee. They are
my
illusion.
And that female fell in love with me, Mr. Igor. She really loved me.
Yeah.
My illusions have just been shattered.
Yeah. Well, they are smaller, but they are rough. I'll tell you, this guy, Mr. Igor, a girl chimpanzee, took a liking to me during rehearsals. And
we had one of our first meetings when I brought some stuff and we went together. Yes, and Mr.
Why was that?
He wanted me to meet your employer.
Mr. Igor.
Well,
hello. And a shaking hand with a chimpanzee. How do you do? He wouldn't let go. She wouldn't let go. I didn't think of it as a she. I thought.
No, you think
psychiatrist.
It's a chimpanzee named Mr. somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
And then years later, what happened? Did she keep? She paid
years
you.
Years later,
and
we were invited to a show at the hotel on Park Avenue, whatever it's called.
And, the Drake, maybe the Drake.
It was a pretty nice, fancy hotel.
Yeah, why can't I think of its name? Anyway, the president.
Waldorf Astoria.
No, the residents used to stay there, but they don't anymore because China bought the place.
It's Waldorf Astoria.
Waldorf Astoria. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we went to the Waldorf Astoria to see Daisy Lewis and Mr. Igor, but it was only Daisy Lewis singing, and on the piano was a bust of a chimpanzee, and that was it. He was no longer in her act, probably because he had gone on to heaven or something.
But the memory lingered on.
Yeah. But it was nice to be invited to see that.
working with animals.
Yeah.
I once had it when Bill Whedon and I were doing our satirical song acts. We were booked to open for a magician in the Catskills. He was driving us up. And so we go up, and one of his tricks was he would produce a duck out of a big platter cover. And we did the job, and at this strange, the Hotel Florida, it might have been called, or the Floridian. Maybe it was the Floridian. On the way back, we heard some strange sounds, and the duck died, so he had to stop. We had to stop and bury the duck on the side of the road. So that was a very strange gig as far as I was concerned.
How do you get a new duck in time for the 8 o'clock
show? It was because we'd already done the show. The duck was good. He didn't die until after the show.
You think he died of stage fright?
Yes, he got stage fright. Okay, a quickie. A quick, that was a band, by the way. Stage Fright, yeah. Nothing like showbiz gigs. Okay, so what's yours, David Finkel?
Oh, Bill Whedon and I were hired as writers for a television pilot that was produced by Mel Torme and a guy named Bill Foster. And we went, and they came to New York to hire us, and everybody, all the other writers were in Hollywood, and we went out for a month. And they lured us, and since I had considered Mel Torme for a long time the greatest crooner that we had, this was thrilling. But when I went to work for him, he was not at a great part of his career, and he was afraid that he had always been hep, but he wasn't quite becoming hip enough. And he called everybody, hey, Tiger. And by the end of this month that we worked on this pilot, which was actually rather clever, he was in competition with us as a songwriter. And when the show was finished, the pilot was run, it was never picked up. And I've now had to fight to forget that whole thing and still appreciate Mel Torme for his singing, which I still think is great. And by the way, people may know this, he was known as the Velvet Fog, which is exactly what he sounded like. He hated that phrase.
Why?
He felt that it was...
Frank Sinatra didn't have any Velvet Fog.
No, he was... And he just didn't want to... And I once said that to him, I love that, and he just got very upset that I would even think to mention that to him. And that was the end of my...
Mel Torme story.
Well, it was a disillusioning gig.
Does he go on the list with Lester Lannan and Alan Funt? Is there any worse an employer that we can name?
I think he could be part of that category.
Part of that group. Yeah. Okay. So what is the moral of the story? Take as many gigs as you can and quit when you must. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you'll be fired.
Or when you're fired, yeah.
Or when you're fired. You will always be released from a gig.
Never quit, always be fired. Because you have to get unemployment.
That's right. That is really the moral of the
story. That's the true lesson.
So all you 12, 13-year-olds there under the covers, never quit, get fired. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's good advice. All right.
And value yourself highly when you're bargaining for what you're going to be paid.
Yeah, ask for more than you're worth.
Absolutely.
Unless you really like it.
If they don't pay you enough, they're going to treat you as if you're not worth enough. That's my lesson.
Okay. So you have a moral of the story, D.D.? You don't need one.
Okay.
The clock ran out. You got lucky. You've been listening to the next hour of Cat Radio Cafe. On this show, you heard us with David Finkel and Alpha Betty Olson discuss gigs.
This program originates in New York City, this week from Cabaret Pangea,
where our audio engineer and musical perpetrator is Lester Lannan's favorite trumpet player, Bob Auld.
And where the art of the cabaret is alive.
With special thanks to Pangea's Stephen Shanahan Theater for the New City's Crystal Field, WBAI's Reggie Johnson, Ken Gale, and Max Schmid, and Ella Fitzgerald, Lorraine Feather, and the band. I'm Janet Coleman, and...
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright.
This has been a production of Cat Radio Cafe.
That's Cat Radio Cafe.
The feline's favorite radio empire.
And remember our slogan.
Do cats take gigs?
No, they work at home. As it's...
WBAI's local station board is the Pacifica Foundation board responsible for local management and operations. The next meeting of the local station board will be Wednesday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the YWCA, 33rd Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, between Atlantic Avenue and State Street. This first local station board meeting of 2020 will also include a delegates assembly to elect WBAI representatives to the Pacifica National Board. Meetings of the local station board are open to the public, and as always, there will be an opportunity for public comment. The meeting is wheelchair accessible. Again, that's Wednesday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the YWCA on 33rd Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. Listeners and the public are invited and welcome. You don't have to contribute to WBAI to come to the meeting, but why not? See you Wednesday. WBAI's local station board is the Pacifica Foundation board responsible for local management and operations.
Celebrate 6 years of storytelling with the Digital Media Training Program. Sunday, January 12th at 3 p.m. at the Rune Arledge Cinema in Lerner Hall at Columbia University, 116th Street and Broadway. You'll be treated to film screenings, award presentations, and our latest documentary, Harlem to Kilimanjaro. Learn about the Maasai culture of Tanzania, East African hip-hop, and more. For free tickets, go to www.harlemeyes.com or log on to Eventbrite and search Harlem to Kilimanjaro. Or call 917-748-4122.
On Tuesday at 7 p.m., join host Teokasin Ghost Horse on an all-Native-hosted, all-Native-produced Burst of Voices Radio. Tune in for global topics and issues of critical importance to the preservation and protection of Mother Earth, presented in the voices and from the perspective of the original peoples of the world. On this week's show, Teokasin's guests are investigative journalist, philosopher, novelist, and filmmaker Andrei Volchek, and Shelley Buck, president of the Prairie Island Indian Community in Minnesota. That's Tuesday at 7 p.m. here on WBAI New York. Amended and restated Pacifica bylaws amendments have been proposed and may now be found on the Foundation's website at www.pacifica.org for review and have been voted on by the Pacifica National Board and are to be voted on by the station delegates, followed by a membership vote.
On Tuesday, January 7th at 10 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl starts the new year with Harmelotic blues man James Blood Omer.
Why did you leave?
Playing with Ornette Coleman.
Why did I leave?
Yeah.
Nobody ever asked me that before. I thought I was fired out of that band.
Join us as we prepare for James Blood Omer's appearance at the Winter Jazz Festival. And Sugar in My Bowl says so long to WBAI. That's Tuesday, January 7th at 10 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Hi, I'm Michael G. Haskins, host of Living for the City on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM Mondays at 11 a.m. Along with senior producer Jillian Jonas, we delve into some of the complexities of living in one of the most diverse cities in America. From the Bronx, Greenwich Village, and Lower East Side to Sunnyside, we speak with on-the-ground activists who are fighting back against mega-developers and too-tall proponents that make the Disneyfication of Times Square look like child's play. We also speak with community leaders and journalists from the Lenape Nation, Black Star News, and the People's Organization for Progress, the underreported stories, hidden histories that so often get overlooked. Living for the City, Mondays at 11 a.m. over listener-sponsored WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Hey, this is Shafi Khan, and you're listening to WBAI.